All right, everyone. Welcome to this fifth episode of Dialogue, Not Division. So, we're trying something a little bit new this time. So, for the first time, we're actually doing a video podcast. So, if you'd like, feel free to join us on YouTube. Otherwise, you can continue listening on audio. So, here on this episode, we'll be talking about three main things that happened over the last week. First is impeachment. The second is Biden's cancellation of the Keystone Pipeline. And third will be some interesting articles that talk about extremism and white supremacy. Moving on, the first thing we're going to be talking about is impeachment of Donald Trump. So, as we all know, the impeachment trial is currently going on. So what I wanted to do is kind of take a look at both sides, the pros, the cons, why some people are arguing for impeachment, why some people are arguing against it, and just really try to take a fair look at it. So of course, why is Donald Trump? Well, of course, there was the insurrection at the Capitol. During that time, there were five deaths, over 50 police officers were injured, and there was a lot of property destruction. So during that time, those five deaths, I did want to break that down because oftentimes I found that that five deaths, in my opinion, is a little bit misleading. So the first was there was a police officer that died. After that, there's quite brutal footage of that. It's an absolute terrible thing. There was also another person in the crowd that was trampled to death. A very, very sad thing. As far as I know, that individual was not taking part in the actual riots. Then there were also two other ones that you often see as just medical emergencies. The best I could tell, neither of these two were actually involved in the riot, but they're often lumped into there. So the one was a heart attack that appeared, I believe, everything I could find was before the actual riot happened, and then the second was an apparent stroke, according to the people with them. Also not during the riot, as far as I could tell. And then, of course, there was the one rioter that was shot. So, of course, you know, many people are blaming Donald Trump, and specifically his speech that happened right before this. So, as we know, the articles of impeachment have been put forward in the past, and now we're at the trial. So I did want to take a moment here, and we're going to go over just these articles of impeachment, or a couple highlights from it. The first one that I wanted to talk about here is it says Donald Trump engaged in high crimes and misdemeanors by willfully. That's a key note here that we'll talk about, and we'll talk about why that's important. Incited violence against the government in the United States. It goes on, but that is the one charge that was brought. Another thing I wanted to look at here is this is exactly what they're saying he said that incited the riot. So here it said that he willfully made statements that encourage and foreseeably resulted in the imminent lawless action at the Capitol. And there the mob unlawfully breached the Capitol, injured law enforcement personnel, menaced members of Congress and the vice president, interfered with the joint session, solemn constitutional duty to certify the results, and overall engaged in violent, deadly, destructive, and seditious acts. So that right there is what is being accused of. And then, of course, what they're seeking, it actually goes a little bit beyond this, but what they're seeking for the Constitution, what they're stating is that he acted he had such conduct that he demonstrated that he will remain a threat to national security, democracy, and the Constitution if allowed to remain in office, and has acted in a manner grossly incompatible with self-governance, and the rule of law. So right there, that's specifically taken right from the articles of impeachment. It does go on to imply one of the other things that they're seeking is they want to bar him, or per the Constitution, they can bar him from holding other public offices. So we'll go into that there. So really what I wanted to do is kind of break down what was actually happening there with his speech or some of the things he said, and really weigh whether or not I think he actually incited violence, and really why I think the underlying parts of the impeachment. And I wanted to try to do this in a way that's fair to both parties and tries to cover it as factually as possible, and of course, I'll still give my opinion. So, what did he actually say that was the incitement? One of the things specifically mentioned that I didn't go over in that is he did say we won this election and we won it by a landslide. That's specifically called in out in the articles of impeachment. Other things not necessarily called out in those articles, but that is being argued right now, is he said things like, we will stop the steal, after implying that the election was stolen. Actually, not implying, he stated it. He also said things like, we will never give up, we will never concede. And other things, the biggest one that he said, and this is the most problematic for him, is he said, if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country. And a lot of people are really keying in on that fight terminology, and we'll kind of look at that a little bit. And another big thing that he said is, because you'll never take back our country with weakness, you have to show strength and you have to be strong. So those are the main things that he said to this to in his rally right before those events took place. There is a lot of going back and forth. What they're saying is that those words fed to that crowd, created the mob that went over and ultimately created the violence. Those words are quite specifically pulled out of the speech, and it's interesting if you look for videos, it's at least for me, it wasn't terribly easy to find of the actual video of his speech, but I was able to find the transcript of it. So I went through and I looked and to try to see if what was being done, I see so much is you pull these little bits and pieces out of things and you try to make them look worse than they actually are. So I wanted to see if that was being done. So we'll take a look at that. But before we start digging into some of that, I did want to cover a little bit on what is required for incitement. So I'm gonna read this right here that was talking about there's one big principle that I found here is really incitement to violence requires proof that the defendant or the person being accused of it. Now, this is the legal terminology that he intended to incite violence or riot. So, as I mentioned before, what was claimed in there is that intention is actually required under the law. If you were getting tried in a court, you do actually have to either intend that or reasonably see that that is going to happen from your speech. One thing that's interesting is in Brandenburg versus Ohio, the court found that careless conduct or emotionally charged rhetoric does not meet that standard. In fact, they even went on to say that actually hate speech does not meet that standard. Basically, you can make racist comments, and there's a lot of things you can say that don't actually meet that standard. So it's just an interesting thing to note that it does require both. It requires intention to do that, as well as it has to be reasonable, foreseeable that that's what you're creating. Another thing that is pulled off of, again, I'm not a lawyer. I pulled this off of a criminal defense site that was talking about this from an actual lawyer. And a little bit later, we'll look at a lawyer's analysis, although I'll go over why I don't really like this lawyer's analysis. But another thing that's required is the defendant must create a sort of roadmap for immediate harm using general vague references to some future act doesn't qualify as imminent lawless action. So what this is saying is you can't say, hey, we should, someday we should rob a bank. And you go, and then somebody robs a bank 3 days later. That doesn't necessarily mean it. Or if they rob a bank, then it doesn't really count. So they do have to create some kind of imminent threat or some kind of imminent action. A lot of people use the example of not necessarily an incitement to cause violence, but of incitement or disorderly conduct, which often follows these same rules of, yelling fire in a crowded theater. You're immediately trying to get people to react in a certain way. It's not, you're not saying one day there might be a fire or anything like that. And what you will see is a lot of people say that as we look at these two prongs here, or in the third one here, was the defendant's words must be likely to persuade, provoke, or urge a crowd to violence. And profanity or offensive messaging alone isn't enough for this. So those are kind of the three ones. I wanted to take those bit by bit and kind of talk about how people are arguing that he met this standard. So of course what they're saying is that he did willfully intend for this. I'm finding that a bit of a stretch. A lot of the things that are happening, or a lot of where I'm seeing that they're saying they intended for this, is before the rally, I believe he said it would be wild. So he said, come here, the rally is going to be wild. Everything that I've heard about Trump's rallies is they're, that would be a normal term to say for them. We'll put it that way. They're definitely emotionally charged from what I've seen. And a lot of people say they're quite interesting. We'll put it that way. So the wild is one thing, saying that they're kind of prepping him for that. I do believe, according to some of the research I did, some of the FBI investigations were actually looking, and some of the groups were created. One of them was created using that terminology of wild, talking about specifically coming over there and causing issues. So they're using that as the argument of they took that wild word that he said before as part of that planning, and we're going to go over there and get wild, meaning be violent. In my opinion, that alone isn't enough. You can say you have a wild party or you're going to have a wild anything, and that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to break the law. Some people might say, okay, well, maybe you could interpret it or perhaps, but I don't think that's enough. And again, I want to point out in this first point is that it specifically says careless conduct or emotionally charged rhetoric does not apply. And as we go through and see, in my opinion, what you will see is a lot of what he said was emotionally charged rhetoric. In my mind, and a lot of people, and we'll go over some of the stats on this, some people would call this careless conduct as well. But that alone isn't enough. We do have to show both intention and that it's very likely to happen, or that he could foreseeably see that it was very likely to happen. And we'll talk about that, what he specifically called for and what he wanted, in a moment. And then as far as the roadmap for immediate harm, most people are using the fact that he used the words march early on in the speech. He wanted them, that they were going to be marching to the Capitol, is vivid terminology, and basically that was doing the imagery of, you know, marching against the Capitol. We'll go over that in a little bit. He also said, you know, let's go to the Capitol. So that's what they're arguing meets that imminent, is, you know, right after the speech, we're going to go there. And again, it has to be likely to persuade, provoke, or urge a crowd. We'll go over how I feel about that here in a moment. But so those are the three prongs that are required if we were going to actually do this as a real trial in the court, according to my research. Moving right along here. So let's analyze some of the things that he did say, or some of these points, and see if he really did intend or specifically call for violence. The biggest argument, or one of the frequent arguments I'm hearing from people, is that he said the march to the Capitol. And I think that's disingenuous. Looking at the transcript of the speech, the only time he used that term march was in the very beginning. And the only time he used the word march was at the very beginning when he said, and this is the quote that I found, "I know that everyone here will soon be marching over to Capitol Building to peacefully and patriotically make your voices heard." So really, when the only time he used that really inflammatory language, that specific one, he immediately caveated it with peacefully make your voices heard. So he very clearly said what he wanted that march to be. He wanted you to march and have your voices heard peacefully. So that's one of the biggest defenses you're going to see, is he did early on in the speech call for the actions to be peaceful. So that's one of the big defenses. One of the counters that I've heard to that is, well, that was early on in the speech, and as it went on, there was more things, so it didn't leave it fresh in people's mind. We'll get to that in a moment. Really, though, the one big thing is the only other references he made to going to the Capitol, he used the term walk, which is a much more minor one, and definitely in my mind doesn't show that he intended for people to march on the Capitol. The other big point that we went over is he told people to fight like hell and be strong. I understand that this could be seen as inflammatory, the fight like hell. However, in context, you can clearly see what it was meant to be, as well as that is very, very common terminology. You know, you fight for people you love. That doesn't mean violence. It's fighting for something is very, very common terminology. It's one that Trump used quite often to talk about things that were not illegal. He uses it quite often. And if you look at the actual content of his speech and how it flows in the sections before that, he's quite specific calling out what happened. And the majority of the content of what I'm saying, kind of this goes back to one of my first podcasts, is he was saying, our voices aren't being heard. We're trying to bring this evidence before the courts. The courts aren't listening to us. They're not hearing our cases, which again, we can debate on that in a different one. He's saying we're not doing this. He specifically talks about big tech not even letting people talk about it, how they're saying that there's no evidence, how they're saying that basically we're not even allowed to bring this stuff up. He's really talking about a lot of cultural issues. And then he goes, we need to fight like hell and be strong. And really, it's quite clear to me that he's talking about the cultural thing, or more about the censorship and really this movement. Now, you can say that's open for interpretation, but I think in context, it's quite clear. I would also say that it's emotionally charged rhetoric. A lot of what he did was emotionally charged rhetoric. Was it responsible? Several Republicans come out saying no. I think I would agree. I think the majority of Americans, as we'll go over and look at, would agree with that. But I don't think it was. And so a couple things he was talking about also along the terminology of that fight is, prior to that, he actually used that term twice, the term fight. And right before he used that fight and be strong, he did say, but our fight against big donors, big media, big tech, that is just getting started. This is the greatest in history. There's never been a movement. And so that's kind of part of circling back, I should say. That's really part of how he's just using that terminology, fight. And it's obvious he's not talking about a call for violence to big tech, all big donors, and all of that. And really, he's just using that, again, that emotionally charged rhetoric. And then as far as, because you'll never take your country back with weakness, another thing he said, the actual quote in context, is, because you'll never take back our country with weakness, you have to show strength and you have to be strong. We have to come to demand that Congress do the right thing and only count the electors that have been lawfully slated. So again, when we're talking about that being strong and taking back the country, looking in context, it's quite obvious what he's saying. He's saying, we are wanting Congress to only count the votes that have been lawfully slated. And with this, it's obvious what he's talking about. On that day, several Republican Congress people or individuals were looking to bring an objection to it. And many in the media talked about this being unpatriotic, treasonous, things like that. I'd encourage you to look behind the full logic of why people did that in the comments, and you'll see that it's not unpatriotic or even unconstitutional. And I'll explain that now. If you listen to Ted Cruz, he actually talks about this on one of his podcasts, specifically how he agonized over this issue where a lot of his constituents felt like the election wasn't fair. Last I saw statistics, I believe it's 1 in 3 Americans felt like that the election wasn't entirely fair. So there was a lot of individuals. Now, of course, the majority of those are Republican. The majority of those people are people that didn't get their way. I will be quite honest there. But there is a big part of people, or a lot of people, that didn't feel like the election was done fairly. And quite a few of the court, or of the cases, were thrown out for lack of standing. Meaning you don't have the right to sue this person. You specifically haven't been injured by this. One of the cases in Pennsylvania was thrown out through something called latches. Basically, it meant you waited too long to sue for this. So they're arguing that they changed the law. Basically, what they're arguing is that they changed the law and against the Constitution. Technically, they didn't even change the law. An individual put in a policy that was against the law. And against the Constitution of Pennsylvania. And so what they were saying is, well, why did you wait till now? You waited too long, so you can't sue. And that's how it got thrown out. One of the interesting things a lot of people talk about is another thing you need, and as seen in some of the other cases, where to be able to sue, you also need standing or injury. Again, I'm not a lawyer. This is from my research, but you also need standing or injury. What that means is you have to be able to show that someone injured you. And the argument there is if they had sued at the beginning when this happened, they wouldn't have grounds because there was no injury at the time. They couldn't make the argument we were hurt by this because it hadn't happened yet. And then what they're saying now, or why they felt like they weren't being heard, is now after the fact they're saying, well, it's after the fact, so you can't sue anymore. So they felt like that they were put into a place where they couldn't sue before and you can't sue after. Some people have argued, I don't know how legally sound this is, but some people have argued that you should have sued before, and then that way when they kick it out for standing, then you bring it back afterwards. I don't know if that would have helped or not. Anyway, I digress. I don't want to go too much into the election thing. I'm not a big person that screams a lot of widespread election fraud. I just haven't seen the clear and compelling evidence, as I've said before, for it. So I don't really want to go over that too much. And what I'm saying is, even if the claims for the election fraud are false, which I don't think you can quite say, you can absolutely say as of yet they're unsubstantiated, and if you want to say that the courts have thrown them all out, absolutely you can say that. So even if the fact that what Trump said is completely wrong, it can be wrong, it could be a lie, it can be irresponsible, and it could be very politically charged, but I don't necessarily think it was quite intention to have or intending to have that effect. And I really don't think that looking at the speech in context, that you could clearly even see that connection. So going down, I want to remind you of how, or kind of address the conversation, how people said, yeah, sure, he said peacefully. Then he kind of left it and, you know, he never said peacefully again. And I want to just say how, according to the transcripts I found, how he wrapped up his speech. And I want you to contrast this with the terminology that people are using from the beginning, where he said march, but then immediately peacefully. Here's how he wrapped up his speech. So we're going to walk down Pennsylvania Avenue. I love Pennsylvania Avenue, and we're going to the Capitol. And we're going to try and give the Democrats are hopeless. Give them support, I believe is what it was. My notes here are missing that word. But the Democrats are hopeless. They'll never vote for anything. Here, what they mean is that motion that was being made, that again many argued was unconstitutional, but really what treasonous, but really what the motion was being made is, we don't trust these, we want an investigation before we allow these certifications. It wasn't saying throw out the results of any election, contrary to what a lot of the news reported or a lot of the people reporting. It wasn't in any way that what those individuals were calling for was, we want, before we accept these electoral votes, what we want is a short investigation, 10 days, just to look into these specific things. We don't feel like the investigation was thorough enough for X reason. And then there was some precedent that they had from way back many, many, many years ago. I think it was over 100 years ago. Anyway, so that's that. So it was talking about that. They're never going to vote for anything, not even one vote for the Democrats. But we're going to try and give our Republicans, the weak ones, because the strong ones don't need any of our help. We're going to try and give them the kind of pride and boldness that they need to take back our country. And then he went on to repeat to walk down to the Capitol. To me, it's quite clear what he's saying is, we want to walk down to the Capitol. This is how he ended it, walk down to the Capitol. And the purpose of it is to support those that we're pushing against or trying to have this additional audit of the individuals. In no way did I find that ending politically charged. I didn't find any of that to really show that he really wanted the violence. Other things that you saw, of course, a lot of people immediately, he got very quickly suspended, a lot of things. A lot of people do leave out the facts too. As soon as it started, he did tweet a message, you know, saying, stop this, this isn't what I wanted. Quite clear from the beginning he said that. Now, some people are going to argue that, yes, he really did want this, but the violence at the Capitol, say what you want about Trump. He can often speak without thinking and do a lot of things, I think, without thinking things through. A lot of people say he just kind of shoots from the hip. generally in the right direction, but doesn't take aim very well. He's not a complete idiot. Obviously, he got elected. Obviously, he has brains. And I think it's quite clear, and he can clearly understand that what happened at the Capitol just makes him look bad and makes Republicans look bad and was overall bad for the party. So again, I want to just really point to those things. To me, the biggest talking points people have about how he actually did it or how he incited it, really, if you look, the most charged ones are immediately followed, or the most charged one was immediately followed by peacefully. And in context, I really don't think the grounds are there. And you heard, if you listened to any of the, you heard his defense here for his impeachment defense. His lawyers drone on, but one of the big things that they were talking about, other than it not being constitutional, is that this is just a what they call is a bipartisan thing to try to, get him one last time, things like that. And we'll kind of go into that as well. But again, I don't think what he said is a clear call to violence. I don't even think you could say that a reasonable person listening to that would actually think that that's what and I think he's smarter than to actually want what happened, because what happened was pointless. It was dumb, and it was bad for everybody involved. So I really don't see it in the speech. You're welcome to have a different opinion. If you're on YouTube or if you're on one of the other channels, you can leave a comment. Feel free to leave a comment. But if you're on one of the others, feel free to send me messages. I'd be more than happy to discuss. But again, I'm not seeing it. I'm seeing a lot of things taken out of context to justify this. So going on, of course, like I said, I'm not a legal professor. So I did look up one of the articles. This one is from BBC. They have a whole thing of what Trump said, what he didn't said, some of what I told you pulled from that. And so they had a section from Professor Epps. I believe he's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore, from what I could see looking up. And here's what he had to say about this, which I thought was quite interesting. So it says it's quite rare that somebody can be convicted of incitement. In applying that to the president's speech at the rally, it's an antagonizing or agonizingly close case. Agonizingly close case. And here's his reasoning. It's pretty goddamn imminent because he's telling people to march to the Capitol and I will march with you. Now, we already talked about that. Looking at the transcript of the speech, march was immediately followed up with peacefully. And when he actually said, we are in, what they're saying, march with you, he was saying, we are going to. He didn't actually go, but he did say, we are going to go to the Capitol. And a reminder, he ended on walk. He actually said walk several times. So interesting, there that they said it that way. And I really think that's disingenuous, and I'll tell you why a little bit here. And then he said, there wouldn't be any time for better counsel to prevail because you're just going to leave the lips and walk down Pennsylvania Avenue. Again, that's kind of continue on that. He said, we're going to go. So that he's trying to set up that this is what's next. And then he said, we have to fight and show strength. But he also said, we're very peacefully and patriotically going to ask. So he's covering himself. He said, in the end, I think it's a jury question. So in this case, he's saying it's a toss-up. We should ask a jury. And it says, I'm not sure he's entitled to a dismissal of charges as a matter of law. There's some discussion that government leaders need to have on leeway. And then it goes on to say that he clearly knew that there were people in the crowd who were ready to and intended to be violent, and he certainly did nothing to discourage that. He not only did nothing to discourage it, he strongly hinted it should happen. So that's why he thinks it's a toss-up. Now, I take issue with this, which is interesting that this professor of law broke it down this way, in my opinion. First off, he's saying he clearly knew people in the crowd were ready to do that. And there was some intel on that, and the FBI had intel why there wasn't better security. I looked into, and it's an interesting long thing. Long story short, the Black Lives Matter protests, there was an gross amount of security. They received a lot of criticism for it. The Capitol police were put in charge of it. The mayor specifically asked for no other federal enforcement there other than what they asked for. And they were just I really feel like it was they were trying to react to that criticism from the other one, so the security went under. But anyway, that I digress. It really doesn't have a lot to do with this, other than the fact that if there was better security, be having this conversation. But so as I was saying, he went in there. He was ready to, and intended. So what he's saying is he should have known the mindset of everybody in there, and because he knew some people were there, he shouldn't have done that. And to me, that's an argument for what he did was irresponsible. You're not responsible for the mindset of everyone that listens to you. You can't be responsible for the mindset of everyone that listens to you. And this is on the left. And if that's the standard we're going to apply, you have to look at some of the things that both sides have done during the other riots that have happened all this year, where people have championed and cheered it on or said things that led to violence. Yeah, absolutely. You had to know that there was a certain percentage of these people that were fed up and absolutely wanted to cause violence because they've been proving, and people continue to say it. But again, you're not responsible for knowing the absolute mindset of every person and for how people misinterpret what you say. So I don't think that's a very good point. And then he goes on to say he certainly did nothing to discourage that. And that's where I just think he crossed the line. He said he did nothing to discourage that. He specifically said peacefully and patriotically. So he did say peacefully. And now you can make the argument that that was earlier on in the in his speech, but again, he absolutely did say something in his speech to discourage it. And then they said he strongly hinted it should happen. Again, we went over that. I don't see how he did strongly hint it should happen. You can take some of what he said and perhaps say that he hinted, but I don't think strongly. So I just thought it was interesting that this law professor went in and kind of made that and made to me what is a factually inaccurate claim that he did nothing to discourage it, when obviously he did say peace. And he said he used words like march, but again, that march was immediately followed by peacefully. And patriotic can make your voices heard. So he said what you're marching to do, and then he started using calmer terminology, walk. So I just thought it was interesting. I wanted to point out how sometimes I think even lawyers, especially when in opinion articles or in this case an article, can sometimes let their opinion slide in a little too much. And again, here I am talking about opinion, and this is in my opinion. So I felt like that short blurb was a little bit lazily done. Perhaps didn't do his homework, or unless the transcript I saw was completely inaccurate. So another interesting argument too is the argument is, did Trump's speech even matter? And more evidence is coming out that a lot of these events were planned, or a lot of this was bubbling up before the speech. There's also I'm not able to 100% verify this claim, but as best as I can tell, the timeline from when his speech ended until when the actual riot started was a matter of minutes when he was over a mile from it. So it was something where people couldn't even stay till the end of his and then start it. I was able to confirm, at least there were some articles talking about how evidently some people left his speech early to go start this. And they were actually saying that they believe that was because of pre-planning, and that they actually, basically had coordinated this in advance. So more and more evidence is coming out where the FBI is looking into this and saying that it was coordinated in advance. So really, it seems like that speech that he did, it likely would have happened whether he did it or not. You could make the argument that that a lot of his other election fraud, his unsubstantiated election fraud claims before added to that. But again, what they're really keying on is those specific words, and that politically charged or just incorrect words aren't grounds for incitement. Yeah, that's really what I wanted to say about that. So I wanted to look at with that, why are we even in impeaching a non-sitting president? As we all know, Trump's no longer the president. He left. The worst he did, after all of the warnings, the worst he did was didn't go to Biden's inauguration. It was a poor sport, in my opinion. So really the main arguments for, because again, I want to be fair and look at this, the main arguments for is they want to hold Trump accountable. So he was irresponsible, according to many. And so really what they don't want to do is let him off the hook. They want to send a message that what you did is unacceptable and we don't want to do that. And I think there's some validness to that. One thing that I wanted to note is that that isn't the only way you can hold a president responsible. They also, Congress and the House also have other tools. They can vote to censure the president. Basically, it'd be like getting a write-up. And that's something that, from what I saw, doesn't happen a whole lot. And what I really saw is, well, we'll get into the stats on that and why I think that might be a better option in a moment. But another one of the main arguments is for healing after the fact. And then, of course, there's a third one to prevent Trump from holding office again. A lot of people think that he acted irresponsibly, that a lot of what he did was exactly that, irresponsible, and that he shouldn't hold another office. And I think that's an opinion that you're welcome to have. Because again, I would tend to agree that I don't think a lot of how he phrased things, what he said, when you talk about I clearly won the election in a landslide, that's just, you can't say that without substantiation. That's irresponsible. Now, can you say that there were issues and irregularities? Can you cite some of the issues and irregularities? Can you continue to say that? I think that's fine, but there is a certain level where you start going above and beyond what you really should be doing. And I really think Trump above what he should have done. So there's some argument there that, and that's what people want to do. So let's look at both the holding him accountable and healing after the fact. So one of the arguments that I've heard sometimes is this is necessary for the nation to heal after the events that happened. So I kind of wanted to take a look at that. To me, if it's necessary for the nation to heal, the vast majority of Americans must support this, correct? This is what they want. They are mad and they want Trump punished for it. They want him to never hold office. So I looked it up. I looked up a couple polls. The poll, the main poll I find, if you Google it, is by Monmouth University. It seems like it was a fairly large poll. They found 56% of Americans support impeachment. 56%. So that's a majority, but that's a pretty narrow majority. And if you're talking about bringing healing to the country, dividing 56% versus the other, again, nearly half, not quite, the other 44% of the country doesn't sound good. It just doesn't sound good. And that, what they asked there was just, should Trump be removed from office? I believe was that one. So that's what they asked. They didn't ask about, should he be removed from office and this. Again, he's already out of office. That relief that they're asking for in the beginning, that's already been done. So that's one of them. Another calculation I saw put the support at less than 50%, but I really felt that there was more respondents. That one was probably more likely, is about 56%. Supported impeachment. So there really isn't this overwhelming majority. So when we're talking and really ramming through impeachment here, I don't see that as a valid argument to a valid argument for excuse me, for as healing as being one of those. So it's just not so. And breaking down those numbers, you'll also see, again, healing is what this is for. So the 84.3% of Democrats, according to the one poll I saw, they support impeaching him. So the vast majority of Democrats, less than half of independents do at 42%, so fairly high, and only 9% of Republicans. So when you hear this bipartisan and they're throwing out this is bipartisan, it really is. It's a divide along party lines. And when you're talking about Biden or anybody else talking about this is necessary for the nation to heal, it's really not. And I think it's going to have that opposite intention or the opposite of that. It really is a way to divide. It's a way to further kind of focus on the negative that another party has done and really do that. So there really, again, isn't a lot of support for that. And as I said, impeachment isn't the only way to punish the president. Censure is another option. And what I saw is that same poll said that there was an additional 30% of people that felt that the president did do something wrong. but that it didn't live up to that level of impeachment. Kind of the argument that I'm making now is that it doesn't really meet that criteria. You have to really stretch the legal criteria for it to meet it. So yeah, he acted irresponsibly, but it doesn't go to that level of impeachment. He hasn't actually committed that high crime or misdemeanor. And but another 30%. So that's a total of 86% of people that they surveyed in here did feel like he did something wrong. And that's really why I think that if what you wanted was healing, that censure would have been a much better option. Because then you would have got Democrats, you would have got a lot more Republicans coming together to say, no, what you did is not acceptable. And it would have held him accountable in some way for that. So it's one thing that just I really don't think that it's healing. It's not healing. And pulling up here, I apologize. I want to pull up one more thing. Just going on to really talk about, excuse me. So when we're talking about Trump running for office and them being afraid of him running for office, or we don't want him to run for office again, absolutely, Trump has hinted and talked about potentially running and in 2024 he's hinted at that and talked about it a little bit, but excuse me, but we really haven't seen it much. I apologize for that. I was gonna bring up another thing here, but obviously that didn't work. What I wanted to point out is Trump lost the election. And according to many, it's the most secure election. I don't know if I buy into the most secure election ever narrative, but according to many, it's the most secure election, and Trump lost it. He lost it by a lot. Now, yes, he got the second most votes for any presidential candidate in history, with the first being Joe Biden. But what I really wanted to point out is a couple things is Trump really isn't. He's really not that popular. It depends on how you measure popularity. You can measure popularity by, Twitter followers, or you can measure popular by how much the average American actually thinks of you. And Trump definitely has a very large hardcore base that really like him. He does. But he also has, I would say, an equally large base of people that dislike him. And you might see this. And you see this when you look at the exit polling stats. Which tried to look, and I found a Morning Consult did a exit poll of over 10,000 people, and they found that 44% of Biden votes were against Trump rather than for Biden. So basically, they asked them, did you vote for Biden because you support Biden or because you don't like Trump? 44%, nearly half of Biden's votes, were saying, it's not that I'm really for Biden, it's I don't like Trump. And other studies have that up to 55%, so even higher. But I felt like that one was the largest study that I could find with the most respondents. And again, that's 44% of Biden votes were more a vote against Trump from their surveys. And one of the arguments that come, well, yeah, I'm sure a lot of people voted for Trump because they didn't like Biden. Those polls that I was able to found, it was only 22% of people that voted for Trump did it because they didn't like Biden more than they supported him. So really, there's a lot of people that don't like him. And in my opinion, it wouldn't be a good idea for the Republican Party to pick up a defeated president in 2024 that has such a large amount of people that don't like him. I don't think he has much of a chance. There is still a pretty big following for him. Trump also has one of the lowest average approval ratings across his whole term of any president that I can about see. His approval rating did vary a little bit. It's pretty low when he initially entered office. It peaked up, and then of course with coronavirus and it went down. And then as we hit the riots, of course, it went down. But if you look at his average approval rating over all of the years, he's only at 41.1% according to the Gallup poll I saw. That's incredibly low. And when you look at that, George W. Bush had a 49.4% approval rating. Obama had a 47.9. Pretty much Trump's figures were the lowest of the many that I was able to find for average approval. So really, I don't think that it would be smart. And I don't know that that's the biggest fear that people should have is that he will office. I get it for a lot of people, that's the large nightmare, but I don't think we want to start the precedent of impeaching people for the appearance of something or trying to stretch definitions of laws to impeach presidents that you don't like or your side doesn't like. Whether you like it or not, he was voted into office by the people and he serves a 4-year term. And that's how it should be, unless he commits a clear high crime or misdemeanor, as it states in the Constitution. I wasn't a big fan of impeaching Clinton as well for kind of the same reason, although I was fairly young when that happened. So overall, I think that risk that he's going to run again and win is fairly low, in my opinion. There are a lot of people that say, "Oh, never count Trump out. He's always got something up his sleeve." But yeah, I'm not buying that one. So my conclusions on the impeachment is it's not bipartisan. It's really not. As we've seen from the statistics, only 9% of Republicans approve of the impeachment. It really is one-sided. It's not likely to succeed. And in my evaluation, from what I'm seeing, it is much more likely to further divide the country and further kind of push into some of the negative narratives that we're talking about of people just coming after Republicans or doing that. I really don't think it's a good way to unify. I would much rather see that censure voted on. You see this a lot, or I see this a lot when you look at like criminal prosecution cases. A lot of times people reach, or the prosecutors will reach for the stars and they try to throw the biggest, worst crime they possibly could with the heaviest punishment at somebody and they just can't prove it. And a lot of times that to me kind of just throws the whole case into a bad light. And I think it's a bad thing instead of just sticking to the stuff that you can prove that you have a really good case. And I think that censure would be a fairly easy win, in my opinion. So overall, I don't think there's a good argument, in my opinion, for impeaching him. If we were to try him in a court of law, I don't think he would be found guilty according to the merits. I could be wrong. And I do think it's a political thing, and it's done out of fear of one, Trump, the possibility of Trump running again. And then two, I do think it's kind of seizing momentum by one side and trying to, shove it in the face of the other. That's impeachment. I really didn't want to talk about it, but since that is the main thing going on, I kind of had to. Another thing that I'm seeing a lot of traction on, or a lot of things, is the Keystone XL pipeline. One of Biden's first orders that he did was to shut down the approval for that and remove that. And you're seeing a lot of what some would call misinformation about it. You're seeing a lot of different things on both sides about it. So I wanted to do a little digging because I know a little bit about pipelines. I've heard narratives from both sides. I used to live in Alaska, and there's a pipeline there. There was some argument about this. Then this Keystone pipeline's been going a long time, so I really wanted to look into it just a little bit and come up with my thoughts on it and share them. So of course, the issue that we're talking about here, there's quite a few problems that people do have with pipelines. So I looked at the most obvious one that comes to mind, of course, is the spilling of oil. So since 1986, pipelines have spilled on average 76,000 barrels per year, or more than 3 million gallons. That's about 200 barrels of oil every day, is what I found. That's from biologicaldiversity.org. So that's quite a lot of oil. That sounds like a lot. Of course, they're associated with other types of events. A lot of the negatives, when I looked up, talked about the overall incidents around pipelines, the deaths building them, there's injuries, there's just overall. And there was one, if you Google it, it just shows this chart of every incident. They put a little pin on the map. And we'll get into that a little bit. But that was another potential downside to it. Of course, there's the potential for wildlife habitat destruction. That's one of the big concerns that a lot of people have, and that's one of the best concerns, I would say. The way how they affect wildlife is up for debate, and there's definitely some negative effects that bills. And then, of course, on the other side, they're arguing a lot for it. Of course, they want better access to those North American resources. So in this case, it's that oil coming from Canada. They're wanting to get that and take that down into the U.S. One of the biggest arguments I'm seeing is that oil is going to be produced anyway, and it's going to go somewhere anyway. So basically, this is going to get transported no matter what. We'll get into that in a little bit. And then a lot of people are arguing that they want better energy independence from that. And the big thing I was seeing there when I was looking at it is a lot of the oil we import comes from unstable countries. There was some argument that was saying that the oil coming from those countries, one, it comes off of basically what are human rights violations, other bad things. It's also that the money that goes into there goes into other states that normally we don't want to be sending money to, things like Iran. So there was a lot of a negative side. I encourage you to look into that if you want, the downsides of foreign oil dependence. And then, of course, a lot of people say debatably it'll keep oil prices low. I saw some different things like that. So what I wanted to do is get into the spill numbers. So looking at that, just the big oil spill numbers and the safety numbers that they threw in my face, I wanted to know. Oh, one of the big arguments that I heard is from one side was, well, they're just trading one form of transporting oil for another one, which means the oil is still going to come. The U.S. is still going to want the oil. They're just not going to have the pipeline. So instead, they're going to create another less clean, less safe oil, or less safe transportation method. So I wanted to look into that, of course. And here is what I found. So this is one of the statistics I found. It pulls in a very large set of data. You'll see here that some of the data is older. This is what's available, but I found this in quite a few different studies. This chart here talks about barrels spilled per billion ton miles. Basically, it's what they're doing is taking how much oil is spilled by the miles that it's transported. And you'll see here in 2002 to 2007, pipelines are nowhere near as bad as tanker trucks. And then all around, the tanker trucks are not the safest. So that was one of the things that I was constantly seeing as I went through is this. And I found many, many different sources talking about this. One of the studies that I looked looked into additionally was from the Fraser Institute. They did a very large study on more modern data, and what they found is both rail and pipelines are quite safe overall, and they're taking into account actual injuries as well. But pipelines are without a doubt the safest way to transport oil and gas, is what they found. And what they also found was the most telling statistic regarding pipeline safety is that 99% of pipeline occurrences between 2003 to 2013 that they evaluated didn't damage the environment. So most of these incidents, all these pins on the maps, really weren't damaging the environment. And what they found overall was oil shipment by road was the most dangerous, very similar to the other one we saw. And again, what they're seeing is the safest one are these liquid pipelines, with much lower ones. I was able to go, and because this is older data, I found multiple different studies. All of them really were really citing that the pipeline was one of the safest ways to transport oil, both that it spilled less than many others and it had less. Another thing I found that was interesting, so this was reported on by the Wall Street Journal. I couldn't find the underlying data, so take this with a grain of salt, but it is widely sourced in many of the research I found, is that the Obama State Department found five separate times that the pipeline would have no material impact on greenhouse gas emissions since crude oil would still be extracted. And then also shipping by rail or tanker would result in a 28 to 42% higher CO2 emissions and more leaks. So again, there was a lot of this evidence that's showing that perhaps what some of the other side is saying is right is that yes, pipelines cause damage. Yes, pipelines spill oil. Yes, when they do spill oil, a lot of times it's large, but really overall, they're a lot safer. And the alternative is to do it by boat, truck, rail, all other things where they're burning a lot of energy, things that aren't clean and potentially could have higher CO2 emissions. Other studies have shown that they have zero emissions. So really, what I'm finding is that there is a good argument for the use of pipelines. However, what I wasn't able to find, and this is where I think the big debate comes in, is the effect on wildlife. I could not find good research on the exact effect that other pipelines or past pipelines have had on wildlife numbers, things like that. Unfortunately, I just was not able to find that in my research. And then the big consideration I kept seeing in the news was the jobs lost. You know, Biden with the stroke of a pen. On Facebook, you see all kinds of numbers up to, I think, 88,000 or 100,000 jobs lost. Again, if you see something like as a large number like that, I'd encourage you to look into it. If you go and do a quick check, the number of current job losses is about 1,000. So right now, the people that were actually employed, once he signed that, lost about 1,000 jobs. It's not 88,000. If you go look at a fact check, that's what they're gonna do. You might see some higher numbers, and it's interesting how the fact checks word things, but there were going to be a projected job openings by the companies doing this for the US of 10,400 jobs for this. That is what was estimated over the construction of this. So if you see a higher number of jobs lost, they might be talking about future or jobs in the future. But as far as those people affected directly today, about 1,000, a lot of the sources say under. Another argument is that many of those jobs were just temporary, meaning they were a job for that period of time for the construction. They were going to go away anyway. It doesn't necessarily make it right, but I don't think that the job loss by itself is a good argument. Does it look bad? Yes. Is it something that doesn't feel good if you're one of those affected by the job loss? Absolutely, it's not going to feel well. And I didn't like what, one of the things is Biden claims, you know, these jobs are going to be created elsewhere. His other initiatives, the green initiatives, are going to create jobs. And, you know, that's for people that actually have lost their jobs. That's great, but that doesn't help me. It's go back to the learn to code movement where people were getting told to learn to code if your job isn't right. Well, that doesn't help you, and not everyone can do that. And one of the things Ted Cruz really pushed on this, using some of those high numbers for onto Buttigieg, which I believe is the or maybe transportation, I don't remember. But he was asking about what do you tell those users, and Buttigieg, in my opinion, didn't have a or tell those people he didn't have the greatest answer. He said, you know, the answer is that we're very eager to see these workers continue to be employed in good-paying union jobs, even if they might be different ones. So basically, it's like, eh, you lost your job, but go find another. Which I don't think was the best answer in that. There was a little bit more. It was a little bit more nuanced of an answer to that, but I don't think that's a great one. And what you will see is some of the people saying to Biden is, hey, if you're going to do something like this that's slashing jobs, you know, try to also show how it could be positive, at least that, especially in this current time where a lot of people are without jobs. But overall, what I wanted to get across in this one is when you're seeing these huge inflated numbers for job losses from the shutting down of that project, just take them with a grain of salt. It's really not that high from what I'm actually seeing. And it is going to have interesting ramifications, though. One thing that's not good for business overall is, to tell them that they're allowed to do something and then yank it back away so that they're really hesitant to make huge investments. So here you're starting a huge project, you're making a huge investment. And overall, for the country, this is, it's going to be a good investment economically. It's good to have businesses invest. It is good to have businesses, give jobs. And then when you take it and you yank it away and it's on and off again, it really affects that, and it makes businesses hesitant to invest in infrastructure. And, we have enough infrastructure issues. So I would encourage people to work with the legislator, and perhaps we could find a better way to make things like this a little bit more foreseeable for businesses, to lower some of those risks. I do understand it's kind of a political hot topic. There's still a lot of debate. There's still a lot of research that either hasn't been done or I don't think it's solidified yet. You see research for and against both of these, so I do understand it's hard. And that's really what I wanted to communicate on the pipeline, is I don't think it's as big a deal as many conservatives are making it. And I wanted to just really show that. I get that it comes across wrong as, you know, somebody signing away jobs with their pen and just canceling things that are starting. But just note, it was about 1,000 jobs currently. It was projected to produce 10,000, I think, 400. But that's future jobs. In theory, we can see job growth in other areas. So that's all on that one. And then the last thing that I wanted to bring up, this came out right after my last podcast. I started seeing this, and it was just kind of maybe a little bit close to me. As I mentioned, I'm a veteran. It's been a long time. I've been out of the military quite a while. But I saw a couple articles and some conversation on some articles that I thought were quite interesting. And I'll go ahead and put those up here. These are the two articles that I saw. One is, you know, the Pentagon stumped by extremism in its ranks, orders stand down in next 60 days. And then another one here, I believe that one is by, so the first one was by Reuters. This one, I believe, was Time. The U.S. military needs to fight extremism in its own ranks. Both of them were talking about white supremacy and kind of extremism in the military. I thought it was quite interesting. And just, I wanted to talk about it a little bit because I was seeing some traction on this as people were talking about it a little bit. And, you know, people were just talking about the military. A lot of people were saying, oh, now they're coming after the military. They're trying to erode trust in the military. Here they go again. And then other people were talking about the military and how it was being used as a recruitment or as a way for extremists to get trained. So I wanted to look into that a little bit. And then I just wanted to, a little bit less stats-based than some of the other ones, I wanted to share some of my personal experience in the military. And somehow I think this may be on the mark or may be off the mark. So one of the things that the biggest things the Time article were talking about was that the FBI investigations of the Capitol riots, going all the way back to that, it seems like we can't stop talking about that, but it showed that members of the armed services were deeply involved at a level well above their numbers in the general population. So what they're saying is active duty and veterans make about 7% of the U.S. population, and 14% of the targets of investigation arrested or charged have a military background. So they were talking about that. I'm not terribly surprised at that number, that it's a little bit higher than the general population. What I will say is military, especially when you're talking about enlisted, I was enlisted, I wasn't an officer, so you're talking about, at the time, normally non-college educated. These are the masses that are introduced. Depending on the branch of the military you're in, entry requirements may not be very high. A lot of times the people that are entering the military don't have other good opportunities. A good amount of people enter the military to try to get the education paid for. Some people do enter it for other reasons, patriotic reasons. But it really didn't surprise me here, because overall the military is, a good proportion of the military is conservative. So you're going to find more Trump supporters in the military than Biden supporters overall. And that's to be expected. So already right there, you're probably going to see that the percentage between the general population and military, yes, you're probably going to see a little bit of that percentage explained there. And then overall, the military is, for the most part, filled with a lot more patriotic people, a lot of people that are going to buy into some of Trump's rhetoric that he's put out. And they're definitely going to, when you start talking about things were stolen, or, you know, you got to do this, that they are more likely, I would say, to, not more likely, a lot of them are going to be more likely to buy into some of that. So it wasn't a surprising number. Another thing they were talking about was white supremacy in the military. I thought that one was the more interesting topic. So when the military, I guess they conducted a poll, Military Times found that 35% of active duty members have seen during their service signs of racism or white supremacy. So it's interesting. I'm not sure what they're considering as those times of racism or white supremacy. And then another big thing that they were talking about, going back to the Capitol riots, to kind of skip back a little bit, was they were talking about how people, when they invaded the Capitol, that they heard many commands that were straight out of the Army and Marine Corps small tactical maneuver doctrine, like cover down, flank, do reconnaissance, we're in. My response to that is, all of that stuff is stuff you're Call of Duty or other video. Military TV, I really doesn't put it past me that this type of people will be saying words like that. They're not that uncommon. You don't have to serve in the military to say things like that. So I thought it was interesting. You got a lot of the people who are doing this were from extremist groups that, that would definitely buy into some of those. So that's kind of there are two interpretations for, or two advice that they put in these articles. One of them was that the military needs to do a better job at training their people to be able to tell fact from misinformation, or to identify misinformation. And I thought that was an interesting point that they were saying. I would argue that we need to do a better job teaching people how to identify misinformation overall. In my mind, Twitter is one of the worst things that happened to America, is the short bites, is, you know, no longer are you reading these big nuanced positions with justification and statistics and, you know, reasoning going into them. What people want are these short bursts, these short pokes at the other side. You see them all the time. That's what gains popularity, is these pokes at the other side. And I think that's terrible. And more people are starting to get their news from Facebook and Twitter and these places that, I'm sorry, you shouldn't be getting your news from. You know, you can absolutely use these as tools to identify issues. For instance, the gun control bill that I went over last time, I first saw it on Facebook. Someone mentioned that. And the first thing when I saw it was, oh, this sounds, in my mind, this sounds extreme. This can't be true. So I went and searched it. I found the actual bill. I read the actual bill. And I verified many of the different claims in that this post had done. So it's a fine starting off point. But I think overall, we need to do a better job of educating the American people on how to dig and do some research for themselves. And I think Americans need to be a little bit less lazy about getting their news from sound bites. And all of those little bites that really just make popular and go viral, take a little bit of time to look into thing. Anything that seems shocking to you, take some time, look into the truth of the matter. Most of the time, it doesn't take long. When you see 80,000 jobs lost for the pipeline, you can Google it. These days, you have lots of information at your resource, or at your fingertips, and it's quite easy to find that. So, see, moving on, when they talked about 35% of active duty members have seen signs of racism or white supremacy, that's interesting. It's an interesting perspective. As I said, my experience with the military, so I was in the Air Force, which, if you look at it, generally speaking, the entrance requirements for the Air Force are higher than most other branches. For the most part, they attract people that score better on entrance tests than many of the other branches. That doesn't necessarily mean that we're all people in the Air Force are smarter, but what I will say, on average, the requirements to enter are more. My career field had the lowest education, or the lowest requirements or testing requirements for the Air Force. My chosen career field. I had many opportunities. So what I experienced, was the entry level was very low. It was a lot of people there were, I would say, below average intelligence. So I got an interesting experience there. And you can say that for a lot of the different jobs in many of the other branches, where a lot of people that enter don't have the best, they don't have a lot of resources. So when I talk about being below average intelligence, a lot of times the people that enter the military, especially some of the branches, they don't have other options. Most of them, at least none that I met, had wealthy, or very few, I should say, that I met had wealthy parents. A lot of them joined because, again, they had no other options. They wanted their school paid for, things like that. Rarely was the sole reason was because they wanted to serve the military, other than some of those that joined directly after 9/11. It wasn't people that had an abundance of opportunity. It wasn't people that already had a fantastic life that they left and then they joined to be enlisted. So really what you got a lot of people that weren't as privileged as many other people's, and they came in with a lot of times what I would say lower education, and just weren't as fully developed. And I'd say me included. I've used the military to get a lot of education, and that was one of the reasons why I entered in. I was a manual laborer before I went in, working with my hands. I was not well educated. I had a high school, of course, but that's it. And went in there. I scored well on my tests, but again, I wasn't college educated. That not that a college degree necessarily makes. But as I go on with that, what I'm saying is a lot of the people there are the type of people that they're a little bit rougher. We'll put it that way. They're rougher around the edges. And there were a lot there going on. But what I found overall for the military is, in my opinion, it was a really good experience for many people because it was very diverse. I think it's something like the last I saw, I believe, 40% of the military minorities. Very high proportion. And so a lot of people coming from different areas where it wasn't diverse, they got thrown into an area where it was diverse. And what I found is those people that were very narrow-minded were quickly had their minds opened. They got to experience a lot of different things. You get to experience people from different cultures. You get to experience people from all different races, and you get thrown in. You give some common values. Most of the branches have some kind of core values that they try to teach, and you have that mission. You have to work together with each other, that you normally depend on each other, and you learn. And what I found is, in my experience, is it was a really good teaching opportunity to bring people of different races, ethnicities, and backgrounds together, and to really break down a lot of stereotypes. So what I would argue, at least from my military experience, I can't speak for every single one, is perhaps a lot of the people entering were ignorant. They might have fallen into the racism or white supremacy narratives, or maybe they just a lot of the stereotypes. And it was a great tool that I saw to really break down that, because you were around so many cultures and you had to kind of learn to get together with people, and you really got to see people for the content of their character, and it broke down a lot of things. And I think a lot of people in the military would agree with that. I'm not saying that I didn't see terrible people there. There were people I did not like. There were people that I felt were shady. There were people that may have been racist when I was in there. But I will tell you, with it being such a high percentage of minorities, I had minority bosses. I had a minority wing commander very high up for the Air Force, commanding hundreds or probably thousands of people at that level. So it was what you saw is a very diverse workforce, which I think was a very good thing. I think it tore down a lot of boundaries. I think that people that have been in the military for a long time, in my experience, it was a good tool to bring people together. And you'll see this, other people in the military that were in the military in my family would probably also agree, is they really learned to not care about the color of people's skin, and all it was about the mission. So I thought it was interesting when they really focused on that. And some of their prescriptions, I think, were off base. I wonder if that article was written by somebody that never served in the military. I mean, likely it was. Because they did talk about other things. Another thing they talked about was military people often don't get the mental help they need. And that's absolutely true. And that's a travesty. And it's something that should be fixed. But I don't necessarily think that the solution is just to teach military people to identify disinformation. That's, in my mind, that wasn't it. And I really think that that environment comes a lot from just the types of people that are going into the military. And it's the pool of people going into the military isn't great, but again, in my mind, I think it's a positive experience for most people of different. Now, I might be wrong. This is only my experience. If somebody had a different experience in there, that's absolutely could be true. It's hard to find further statistics on this. So I just wanted to share my experience and how I thought that the military really was a great way to bring people together. It was that melting pot that you talk about the America being, and really just overall a place where at least I saw minorities succeeding. And I thought that was a great thing. It's a fantastic time where I got to just learn so much about different cultures, meet people from all over the US. I got to meet people from Guam. It was just fantastic. Even immigrants were there. Some people would join, trying to get their pathway to citizenship. It was just a great way. So I'm not saying that there isn't a problem in the military. I think the military has a lot of problems. There is some research out there that I saw when I was looking at it, what I alluded to earlier, where some gang members were joining them. Excuse me, joining the military. There was some evidence that they were joining the military to try to get training, come out and use it against. It seemed to me that a lot of that was a lot less than has been stated, than people see. You do see a lot of, they were talking about a high percentage of people being gang members that joined the military. And I saw that more as people that were trying to exit a life where they didn't have opportunities and use the military to do that. So that was my thought on that one. That one hit a little bit close to home, I guess I would say, when talking about that. It'd be interesting to see a similar poll done with so they, right there with they're talking about 35% of active duty members have seen signs of racism or white supremacy. I'm curious what would happen if you did a similar poll like that in other career fields or other areas other than the military. One of the things we talked about last week was that we talked about defensive use of forces and defensive use of force, and you know there was some crazy high numbers over how many times it happened. And we talked about surveys when oftentimes when you ask, have you ever done this or seen this, that it would overreport, and that was one of the things, because really you're having people search through their mind trying to pick that pick any incident that fits this category, and people want to say yes. So I'm curious. I'd like to see more statistics on that. I'd like to see how that compares with other jobs with the US as a whole, and really dig into that. Maybe that's a topic for another day. But I did want to spend a little bit of time to share some of my experiences with the military, a little bit about that culture, a little bit about some of the positives that I think that really come from the military, because really it is a great way to turn around your life. It's a great way to get ahead. It's a great way when people talk about free college education. Now, not everyone can join the military depending on your pre-existing conditions and what you have, but for me, it was a fantastic way of moving from that at the time, heavy equipment mechanic welder, moving from that into something different in the military, and then ultimately using the benefits there to get my degree, to go on and move to better career fields and really further myself. And I see the military as providing that real opportunity for people of all races to get ahead and to make up for those resources that you may or may not have. Because again, not everyone has parents that can pay for their education. And And not everybody will do that. So overall, my military experience, I think, was a positive thing. There were a lot of negatives in the military. There are a lot of problems in the military. There are a lot of problems I think that should be addressed. But I wanted to share that. Really, that's all I have for this week's episode. I thank you very much if you stuck by this much, and I will see you next week.